Okay, welcome everybody to another episode of Morelia Python Radio. This is episode 559, and we are here with Dale DiNardo. We're going to be talking about Python eggs, what's going on with the female when she's about to lay those eggs, and everything in between. I think this will be a good one. And I don't know, Owen, do you have anything you want to hit on, or we just get right into it?
Lucas is here.
Hello.
Throw that in there as well. I didn't forget you, Lucas, because I care.
I just assumed they would see him on.
I don't really know.
Happy to be here, Dale. We've had the pleasure of chatting once before. We have a common friend in Todd Trowbridge who introduced us, and I'm a. Definitely a fan of his work at Arizona State University, and hope I can help contribute to the conversation.
I'm sure you will.
That's why we bring him. Yeah.
He's the smart one of the group.
Good intern. Good. I got nothing. I'm just.
Okay.
Yeah.
Let's just get into it.
Yeah.
All right. Dale, welcome to Morelia Python Radio. Maybe you could just start by telling us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into reptiles and what you do with reptiles currently?
Well, I think like most of us, or a lot of us, getting into reptiles happen about birth. You know, it's like you wake up and you just all of a sudden chasing, grabbing snakes, picking them up. You don't even know what you're doing. It's just, I think for a lot of people, it's just the ability to actually hold the animal. Like birders, they just get to watch or hear. It's for some people, that's okay. But how many herpers just want to watch or, you know, and nothing
cares? Yeah, I know.
So I was always interested. And to this day, my brother always says, you know, you still do what you did when you were 6 years old. And I said, some of that's true. I'm still chasing snakes and fine playing with snakes, but a little more complicated nowadays with research. So I went into, school, and I'm a veterinarian, but also have a PhD in pretty much a environmental physiologist. So I'm interested in how animals cope with environmental challenges, particularly resource limitations, things like energy limitations, water limitations, and of course, thermal limitations, too cold, too warm, and the process there. And we've been working in terms of from the Python world, I've been using children's pythons for about 25 years because they're like the little lab mouse of snakes in terms of ability to breed and maintain and keep them, you know, unlike the typical breeder that has all these different kinds of cages and has different species and different things in there. And they do different things with each one. You know, mine's about repetition. It's about having large numbers, mm-hmm. all the same cages, everything same, except for whatever variable we want to manipulate. So we can learn about these. And one of the big things we got into was studying endothermy and, you know, the shivering they do, and basically documented that it's actually very few pythons that produce any significant amount of heat, even though it's thought that pythons across the board, it's basically three species. It all depends on who you talk to and how much you split things up in terms of species. But a very small percentage of the ones looked at have been are endothermic. And then we also got into the parental care side of things and to think that reptiles and parental care, but these snakes aren't just coiled on their eggs to protect them. They do a lot to regulate gas exchange with these eggs and water loss from these eggs. So it's been pretty exciting. And we use them a lot again to look at effects of things like hydration state, because a lot of pythons you think are tropical and they're just, in this warm, wet place. But in reality, a lot of them are in these wet, dry forests where there's a long dry season, and a lot of these snakes breed and females are on the eggs during the dry season, so that hatchlings are come out right at the beginning of the wet, so they get the longest possible time to feed. So they're really a good animal to look at to see how hydration state impacts organisms and kind of the mechanisms they have to mitigate any effects, both, and we look at how it affects the female as well as the impact on the eggs and how much she tries to mitigate impact on her eggs and sort of take the brunt of any impacts. So that's what we do and been doing for 2.5 decades or whatever, 3 decades. So feels like yesterday I started, but it's just exciting because it's always something new. And it's always fun talking to breeders, because breeders are the best at breeding these animals and look at things. But like I said, a lot of times breeders see things and they make conclusions without actually, you know, carefully getting data. So the combination is really nice that I get ideas and share my results. And then we, you know, we can put it in a control setting and really use it not to just learn about how to breed snakes, but using snake, because I can't get money, funding, to, you know, grants to breed snakes. Yeah, it just doesn't. I mean, it's hard to do. Just doing it as a hobby, right? To make a lot of money. But what I can do, though, is use them as a convince people that they're a good study system for looking at things like parental trade-offs, like what a parent, the cost to a parent versus cost to offspring, or you know, offspring have a lot of demands. They have they need protection. They need food. They need gas exchange. They need things, and the female has to provide these. And or in some species, like birds, it's two parents. But you can't do them all the same. If you're sitting on your eggs, you're not collecting food for the eggs. If you're a bird, let's think about that.
Right.
So there's a trade-off. Female has to make decisions of what to do when to optimize that parental care of the offspring. So, and with snakes, it works really well because they're doing everything. These pythons do everything in a small space. They don't leave their eggs to go forage or do something. They're actually there, but they are doing things. They're having behaviors that we have identified that differentially affect the egg environment.
Does that change throughout incubation of what she's trying to take care of or manipulate?
Well, the biggest change that occurs that they need to address is that these embryos, when they're in the egg, first of all, about a third of the development of pythons occurs inside the female. So those eggs in the female, it's unlike a bird egg, which comes out and no development's really happened. Most reptiles, about 20-25%, but pythons are about a third of their development. So a lot of times you can screw it up even before the eggs are out, you know, in terms of you can screw up the eggs if your female doesn't have the right environment. Especially, you don't have to worry about moisture and all that because females, it's a moist environment inside her, but you know, temperature regulation is real critical during that time. But
I think I've messed that up a few times.
Yeah. I mean, like, oh, I always get bad eggs. It's like, you know, it must be infertility. Well, but if you see like the little vessel there or something and then it got fertile, it died because it didn't have the proper.
Something else went. Yeah.
Something inside of mom. Yeah.
But the thing that has to be considered, whether they're live bearing or egg laying animals, is embryos have relatively low, oxygen uptake, low metabolism until the last week or so, 10 days of development prior to hatching. If we're just talking about pythons, python eggs, and that change means now you have to get more oxygen to those eggs, to those embryos in the egg. And so you've got a shell to deal with, which is a barrier. Then you have a mom around that clutch, which is a barrier. And the other one that we've never looked at, I was curious, is for pythons, especially all things, but especially pythons, how closely they stick together. For a lot of them, they have their siblings that are also barriers to oxygen. If you're an egg in the middle of a clutch, you're mostly separated. Gases have to go either through those little cracks or through, you know, the other egg. You know, the theory, there has to be a cost to being a middle egg type of thing.
Yeah.
Even though we see hatching success pretty similar, there is a benefit. You get less oxygen, but you lose less water too because you're surrounded. But anyhow, so this metabolism goes up at the end, we have to have adjustments, and both. And there, we've documented adjustments of both sides. One is the permeability of the egg is reduced. Anybody that's bred pythons, you know, they're about to hatch when
condensation on the egg
in, and all of a sudden condensation all over the cage, right? You all get about that. Well, why does that occur? Why is that condensation occurring? Well, all of a sudden the shell is thinning, and with the thinning of the shell, and it's allowing more oxygen to fuel the metabolism of these embryos. But also, water is also a gas, water vapor. And so if oxygen can now move through the shell more readily, so can the water. But at that point, the snake has a lot of this water already internally, right? It's not egg yolk and egg fluids. And so at that point, these eggs can cave, and that's fine. You know, if you have eggs caving early, that's problematic.
Not good.
You don't get them and go back up. But late on, we all know that they sink, then you get condensation, and you're all excited that soon you're going to get some hatchlings. So the egg makes an adjustment. The embryo itself, by thinning the eggshell, and we've shown that we've taken out eggshells and put them in artificially and looked at passage of water and stuff through these. But then the female also, because she's coiled around them, unlike a bird nest, birds make a nest and they sit on the eggs, but their nest is porous. A lot of air gets through those twigs and stuff. So those eggs are exposed to normal oxygen concentrations. Whereas we've shown that pythons coil so tightly around eggs. In fact, you can pick up like a sometimes a children's python, you pick it up, coil around the, and you can't see any eggs. Mm-hmm. Even on the bottom, yep. Close it off. Now, that's not common. Usually it's more of a honeycomb type, you know, a
beehive.
They tighten them. We've shown that that actually not only lowers the oxygen concentration among the clutch, but actually to a point that impedes, that affects development, affects their heart development, affects their metabolic rate. And so coiling around the eggs is not a free thing for the embryos, but it's better to have be a little oxygen depleted than to desiccate.
Yeah.
Because as you allow, I mean, if you take, I don't know if you guys have done, but if you ever take a python egg and you put it on a scale and you just abort, you know, you just recently watched some grass grow, but you want something a little tiny, the next thing, you can put a python egg on a scale and you can watch the weight drop over time. I mean, it doesn't take long. I mean, 10 minutes, you'll watch it lose. I mean, as it's just dissipating. You do that with a colubrid egg, you don't see that as much. And so that's another question. Like, what came first? Coiling around the eggs to prevent that water loss through these very porous eggs, or the eggs became very porous because mom helps me protect from water loss. She's surrounding me, so I don't have to worry about
that.
But I do have to worry. I do need to be thin to allow gas exchange in this depleted oxygen environment. So it's like chicken or the egg. Well, this is the python, the female python or the egg brooding versus, you know, the eggshell. So it really is, you know, there are all these questions of how they're dealing with it. But the female will also change when the female's tightly coiled. If you, again, if you're, you know, bored, even if you're bored of watching the egg lose weight, the next most exciting thing you can do, you have to be careful because this gets really exciting. Actually watch the female. She coils very tightly with her head sealed over the eggs. You can't see the eggs. And about every 10 minutes or so, she'll move her head to the side and kind of wiggle her things. And then for about a minute, and then she'll cover it up again. And people go, oh, she's just stretching or not. But by doing that, all of a sudden you get this enormous efflux of CO2 and water from the clutch and an increased oxygen depletion coming through things. It's basically they're kind of ventilating their eggs.
Yeah.
And then even less frequently, they have what we call an exploratory. The female will not only just move her head, but she'll start ducking her head between the eggs and the shell. I mean, between the eggs and her body to really explain that. What she's doing, you know, we assume she's assessing the environment. Is it, you know, is it getting too wet in here? Do I have a bad egg? And, you know, if it's bad eggs that aren't stuck, they do kick them out a lot, you know, but oftentimes they're stuck to things. So, but they'll do this exploratory behavior. But just this opening and closing where they just move their head to ventilate these eggs, they increase the frequency of that as it gets toward the end of development. So, but they only do that if it's in a moist environment. If we put them in a low humidity environment, they keep it at the low rate. My eggs desiccate, they're dead. If they're low oxygen, they're going to take longer to develop, but they'll come out. And like I said, we see things like enlarged hearts from embryos from oxygen contents of eggs. But once they hatch and they've been in normal air, the development's dynamic, and so they can readjust, and the hearts actually get back to the same size as control animals, that eggs that you develop, you know, outside the family. We didn't do it female, and we're surrounded by a female or not. We just did it under conditions where we gave them the oxygen concentration. We know when they're surrounded by mom, the oxygen concentration. We know when they're surrounded by mom, just always surrounded by mom, but she ventilates periodically. By moving, and then just fully exposed. So, you know, they are different levels, and we don't see changes. We see differences in the ones that are coiled. So that it's not free. The mom's providing a lot to those embryos, but there is a cost. And I always tell my students, everything has costs and benefits. There's nothing that's even an evolution. It's not like, oh, they evolved this and that just made them better. It made them overnight better. But some things are better and other things are worse. You think about highly specialized anteaters, highly specialized tongues to get ants. They're better at catching ants, but they really suck at catching anything else. Right? You know, it's like
there's no such thing as solutions, just trade-offs, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Oh, yeah.
And you can say it's a solution because it enables you to do better because of the environment you're in, but it also kind of pigeonholes you into a lifestyle, or as you develop these more effectiveness at doing particular things, you become less, you know, jack of all trades, master of none. And if there's a lot of competition, you want to be a master, and therefore you lose this ability to adapt. But, you know, we see both. We see animals like, you know, coyotes, they're extremely adaptable to anything, you know, and they maintain that adaptability. And we see animals, like I said, the anteater that, you know, is dependent on ants. You know, whereas coyotes, you know, even if they did eat ants or something, or any food that coyotes eat, if you took it away from them, they have other things they can
find
eat.
Another one. Yeah.
You know, so it's just different evolution trajectories that enabled these animals to be more successful overall, but there's no perfect situation. There's no perfect solution. The same thing is true with these pythons and whether they brood their eggs or not.
I suppose you could even extrapolate that concept all the way zoomed out to the difference between egg layers and live bearers in the first place. Right. Do you have any thoughts on why this group of snakes ended up being a group that lays eggs rather? Like, what is the advantage of going through all of what you just explained versus just holding them in and pooping out live worms?
It's a great question because, like I said, a third of the development is inside moms. So that's basically live bearing for the first third. And then the rest of it, instead of laying it and running away, then they're still with the eggs until hatching. So they're completely investing. So why not just, like you said, keep them in and poop out babies? And there's probably...
I'm a scientist.
That's a formal word.
It works.
Right. Well, we can use other words, but these four-letter S words get us, problems. So one of the problems is, again, in order to have live babies, you've got to be able to provide oxygen in large amounts for that latter part of development, that they're low and then all of a sudden they have this high demand. And when it's inside the female, that can be trickier to do that. And so and viviparities evolve probably 120 times in squamates and lizards and snakes. So it's evolved readily. And so, but that there's that potential benefit of doing it. But there, again, there's a cost. And one of the costs is, how do I provide enough oxygen for the late part of development? Early on, holding them on longer, they still have low metabolism, not a big deal. But so it could be that pythons, and again, there's no perfect solution. So they said, okay, we can get all the benefits of being viviparous, but instead of developing better oxygen delivery to eggs, we can develop brooding. Mm-hmm. And then we have brooding. And so it's, again, achieving a high level of parental care, because having live babies is parental care. Mm-hmm. You know, it's you're taking care of the offspring. It's not voluntary. You got to go through with it. But you know, that's like, that may be one advantage of having a clutch. And we've looked at water pythons up in the Northern Territory of Australia. And notice that if you have water pythons and when they go to lay their eggs, and Rick Schein did a study years ago, and then we repeated it to the site of things, but did it again. And both of us showed that with water pythons, some of the females abandon their eggs in about the first 10 days.
Right.
And if you go more than 10 days, I don't remember the exact number, but if you go more, and that's why we publish this stuff. It's not for you, though. You guys know. So I can remember what
it is. You read it. Yeah.
But
the hell did it?
So
that study is a favorite of the program.
But it's 10 days or the entire time. There's no in between. Females that left, they left early. And if they didn't leave in 10 days, they stuck it out for the whole 50 something days. And the advantage of leaving the eggs is that for these water pythons, they feed mostly on these dusky rats. Right at the beginning of the monsoon, there's a big surge in the presence of these rats. So if you're sticking on these eggs for 50 days, it's only 50 days of 12 months, but it's 50 days out of what is probably a 3 to 4 month feeding period. Mm-hmm. So you're losing at least half to two thirds of your feeding opportunities. It doesn't cost you much to stay coiled on the eggs, but you're losing the opportunity to gain the energy. Those eggs weigh about a third of the female's body mass, right? So she needs to gain more mass, and she's sitting on these eggs instead of foraging. So it enables a choice. It provides some flexibility that I'll stay on my eggs or I'll leave them. And if the conditions are just right for the eggs, if the conditions are perfect, females abandon their eggs. Like if they lay these eggs in these termite mounds, which Rick Schein has shown. If they lay them in these root bowls, where conditions are pretty good but not perfect, females stay on them and just provide that extra buffering that they can do to the environmental conditions. If they choose so we both showed that middle one. They stay on them if they're in this good but not perfect world. If they're in a perfect world, like in these monitor or these termite nests, which the problem with that is they get raided by monitor lizards, dig them up easily and lose a lot of eggs, but females abandon it. But if you have the other thing where they lay in such a – they choose poorly, you know, and they lay in a bad place. It's cool down there, whatever. Then they can just leave. They leave for those 10 days and then they can go feed. I made a mistake, but I'm not paying for it for another 2 months because I have to give birth to these very poor quality offspring if they even survive.
Right.
Which is, hey, I can cut my losses and now go feed. So maybe I can breed probably not the next year, but in 2 years instead of three type of thing. So that laying of the eggs may be required because they can't provide enough oxygen to those embryos. Instead of developing that adaptation, they develop this parental care. Mm-hmm. And it could be actually selected for because it allows choice. And we know, at least in water pythons, that they have this choice. And in both of them, they did this exact same thing. They spend about a week to 10 days assessing their decision of where they laid their eggs. And at 10 days, they say, let's stick with it, or let's cut it, cut our losses. And, you know, and other species, like the reason I use children's python, one is they're small, they're very easy to breed, but they are dedicated mothers. I can take a children's python off her eggs. I can collect blood from her heart. I can put her in a respirometry chamber, measure her oxygen consumption. I can put her eggs in a respirometry chamber. And after a few hours, I throw them back together. She coils right back on. You know, and then really? We have things like we did a big comparative looking at endothermy, ability to prove heat. And so I had over 200 adult pythons. It sucked. I had all this stuff. And more than trying to breed pythons and actually collect data. But things like, and then you finally breed them and some of them, womans, which are pretty easy to breed, but you pick up the container that she's wrapped in her eggs on, because we don't, you know, not fancy aquarium, we can find them. Mm-hmm. Once you do that, she leaves them and she won't go back on. And we had, you know, over and over again. So we just had to actually, before they lay, we had to put them in the respirometry room all set up. So she lays there and we never have to pick her up because, whereas, you know, I can almost juggle the children's pythons. So, you know, we just got, you know, we looked at all these different species, but we've done so much more. We got so much more data then with children's pythons, so we've continued using them because they're just such a good system. Again, it's not about learning. That's your job, Owen, to breed all these different pythons. My job is to learn and understand what's going on and trying to understand. And hopefully, from what we understand, which is a broader standard of trade-offs and parental care, also provides value in the breeding side of things, because it's a good combination, this anecdotal experiences, hunches that, you know, breeders get from just their dedication to it and their observation value, combining it with, yeah, we've shown that, but in reality, it's actually this that's happening. And sometimes it doesn't matter what the explanation is, as long as you don't have to do. Other times, if you have the wrong explanation, you take the wrong road.
Right.
Of what you want to do for the animal, you're actually making things worse when you think you're trying to make things better. Or if, you know, you try to breed things, you change six different things and it works. So for the rest of your life and everybody else's lives, they're going to do all six of those things when it may have been just one.
Just, oh, yeah. Right. No one's
just, okay, let's figure out which one it is, right?
Right.
You know it works.
Right.
Don't change anything. Don't move anything. Just stick with those changes. So, you know, hopefully it has value at the herpetoculture level. And, you know, like I said, yeah, I love chatting with people in herpetoculture because in many ways, you know, you guys are so much smarter than me. And in other ways, I'm so much smarter than you. And when we bring it together, it really is.
We actually start getting stuff done. Yeah, it's
so many researchers or even zoos, you know, oh, the private breeders are where it's like, private breeders know what they're doing because they're doing it. You know, they're dedicated to it. It's the spare thing. They have most have a real job where they're trying to make a living breeding snakes.
Right.
You know, it's better to have a real job.
Yeah. No,
right. Either way, you're investing, you know, it's your life. It's not like you work at a zoo and you have a paycheck coming in and, you know, you're trying. And, you know, and zoos like that, they need variety. And so they don't have, you know, 5, 6, 10 pairs, or for me, 75 females. Mm-hmm. At one time that you can do these adjustments. Yeah, we got it that high. Usually I was trying to keep it at 50 so I can have four groups of 12. I can do a 2x2 experiment.
Okay.
48 females. And I like having a little more than that. It's not, of course, not everyone breeds, but with children's mm-hmm. pythons, I get over 90% of them breeding every
year. Yeah.
Something close to 100% some days, some years.
Nice. I do have a story, and then maybe you can. I do have a question. All right. So my story is, the first time I tried to do maternal incubation was with a Papuan carpet python. And basically I kept putting the nest box, say, under the heat, and she would move the nest box to the point where I
started. So you're saying she was smarter than you?
Yeah, yeah, she was 110%.
100%.
Sorry to interrupt.
So she kept moving it back to the spot. So finally I just sort of, you know, and this was the first time I've ever bred pythons. And so my question is, how does the female go about, like, what is she doing to select for a nest site? Do we know that? Is there any theories on that? Like,
selection of the nest site, we're not sure. That's, like I said, water pythons, some of them make mistakes. They choose the wrong place. Right. The ones with the when they choose a termite mound versus these root bolts, they're both winners. It's just you abandon the one that's high mortality. You can abandon them, leave them alone, and they'll survive just fine and hatch as long as the monitor doesn't eat them, which mm-hmm. happens often. So, but you know, but sometimes they check they choose poorly and they have a wrong site. So, you know, it's not perfect. But we do know that the way they're sensing whether they're in a good environment or not, it's not their body temperature. It's actually the temperature between the egg and her that drives the temperature that they'll regulate. And we've done this like with Burmese pythons, which, you know, produce heat and generate it, but they're driven and they discern the heat, not by how much they raise their body temperature, but they can sense that temperature of their belly against the eggs. And that's where I think a lot of these pythons, when they do this exploratory behavior, like I said, they're probably sensing humidity, they're sensing temperature, they're sensing a lot and making decisions. Now you can't, it's hard to move, you know, that whole clutch, but in terms mm-hmm. of choosing a good nest selection, I mean, that's deeply rooted ancestrally. I mean, almost all squamates do that, or at least all egg laying, mm-hmm. but even most live bearing squamates, you know, we do a lot of rattlesnake work too. I know they're not Morelia, but,
we still like rattlesnakes.
You like rattlesnakes?
Yeah, we still go looking for them.
But
yeah.
we've done a lot with them, and showing, you know, these females will move to what we call often rookeries. They're not bird mm-hmm. rookeries with hundreds of thousands, but you can have three females that are and they're rattlesnakes, and they'll all lay in a common area. And so there's, you know, they're not doing it because, like, I have people say, "Oh, they're probably sisters." It's like, yeah, I mean, they're all focused on what they need, and they all independently determine this is a good spot. And so they're there. But so, you know, there is a lot of site selection is so grounded into, I think, squamates in general, reptiles in general, and birds even. And birds, they control it a little more. But, you know, turtles, snakes, lizards, crocodilians, choose nest sites. And, you know, because it is tricky. Like, they sense the temperature of the nest and all that. But that's the temperature now.
Yeah.
What about the temperature tonight or a month from now? Mm-hmm. How do they know that this is that the temp, maybe the optimal temperature that you want your eggs to develop at means you want to look for a place to lay that's cooler than that, because as the summer warms up, mm-hmm. you're going to get, I mean, these females, you know, we don't know how, I mean, it's innate. They're not learning this. They're not reading about it, but they are, it's in there. But how is that journey? How is that decision made to find, you know, that particular environmental condition that's going to make it. So we don't know much of, but we do, more of ours has been, you know, after laying, looking at these adjustments in the females, mm-hmm. sensing the environment and knowing whether to, especially these ones that produce heat, whether to produce more heat or not. But even the other ones, if you keep children's pythons warmer than they should be, you know, not cooking them, but warm, they will loosen their coils dramatically. And because it gets getting too hot, like I said, they favor water conservation over temperature and oxygen. Water conservation is the most, but if it's so hot, they know their eggs are going to cook. They just open up, and usually the eggs just shrivel out too over time. Mm-hmm. But they're trying to make that adjustment because they are recognizing that it's too hot of an environment.
Something's wrong. Yeah.
Go ahead. Sorry. Sorry. Just real quick. One of the things that I've heard hobbyists, kind of guess at is that they think when the mom is sticking her head into the coils, perhaps she's taking temperatures with the labial heat seeking pits. It sounds like what you're saying is that the evidence suggests more that they're able to gauge that from the ventral scales directly.
It seems like they can sense, like you can sense heat on your skin, right? You know, or even just a warm thing versus a hot thing. And I think, you know, eventually, because remember when they coil on them, they're not just flat against the egg. You know, they kind of, sometimes you don't coil a female, there's an egg stuck. You know, if they're a separate egg, just trapped in there. So they have a lot of contact. So I do think they're sensing temperature. They can sense it from their belly.
Okay. So perhaps a bit of a misnomer there.
It's not the only way there. I don't think they have to do that for sensing temperature. I think they may get an idea, but I think they have the temperature figured out. I think they're more down there saying, how humid is it? And their condensation is, you know, python eggs extremely sensitive to condensation. Mm-hmm. You get a drop or two on them and boom, they're gone. Whereas you can take Klubert egg, drop it in the water, leave it there, pull it out, and they hatch. You know, I mean, I literally had these water-based incubators, and I was pulling one thing out, and I spilled the incubator, the little shoebox I had, and spilled it, and they went in the water. That, you know, it helps keeps the incubator constant temperature and humid. It's like they're all in there, and you know, it's like I just pick them up, and every one of them match. You do that to a python, it's done. You might as well just
crash them and goodbye. Yeah,
go beat yourself for doing something stupid. But
you know, when you were talking about the nest selection, the question that I was gonna, you know, we've heard people say on the show that, like you take like a Brettles python up in the trees, that they would have eggs already in the nest. that she's there. Is there any thought that they're returning to that same nest because of the idea that that it was a good temperature and a good?
There is. I don't know if there's a lot. There's not really evidence that they return frequently nests. I mean, even with Shine, with these root bowl nests and these paper bark, the termite nests and these root bowls and the paper bark trees, females tend to repeatedly use whatever type of, not the same nest, but the type of, whether it's a termite. But that's also because of, there are areas where there's a lot more termite mounds and other areas where there aren't, right? And so it's not like, but they do document females that did move between the two and did it. But I'm not aware of I'm not saying it doesn't exist, but I'm not aware of a significant amount of data. Maybe, you know, anecdotally, oh, we found the snake in here twice. But if you follow 100 snakes around on successive clutches, do they ever go back to the same nest? I mean, that's be a lot of work. Right. But I don't know of any evidence that really suggests they'll go back to a place where it was a successful nest.
Gotcha.
Not saying it doesn't happen. Just I don't know.
Right.
I think it would also depend on their range too. Like we found Darwin carpets in the botanical gardens in Darwin, and it's like they had a really nice setup. So I don't imagine they'd really be going too far away from that enclosed garden area surrounded by city where food was coming available. So there might have been overlap, just because these female carpets that live in the garden aren't going to go. Exploring.
But even for those females, are they going to go to the exact same spot?
Right.
Or are they just, hey, you know, and the odds are if you're not, and you got to be careful when you're examining data. It's like if you're in a place where they don't move around much because they have everything needed. And I truly believe home range, so territory, home range size is dependent on, you want it as small as possible for the most part for females, but it's got to be as big to get your resources. So if you have a smaller home range where you can get all your resources, the odds of you using the same spot 2 years later is higher than if you have this enormous area that you cover because you're going to be in different areas. And, you know, like I said, and we do have, like with the rattlesnakes, we do have rookery area spaces that are used by different females, you know, like every year there'll be a female to there, but, you know, not just the same female. We've seen females that we know have nested out of rookery and next 2 years later or 3 years later are nesting in a different spot. And so I think they're
with I know this is rattlesnakes and not pythons, but do the rattlesnakes offspring return to those same rookeries at all? Has there been any studies with that?
There isn't, because I mean that's a long investment that you'd be following snakes to see if they return.
Following a lot of baby snakes for a long time,
most of the baby snakes are going to be old and dead, you know. But
my ideas are impossible.
Cross that one off.
I don't think for the rattlesnakes live in the desert where you don't have a risk of freezing. It's like diamondbacks and. We have, you know, they're on the ground. They don't den up much and make it a few together, you know, and then you go up to things like Arizona blacks before you even get up way in Lotosis, high latitudes. But even if you get a higher elevation, you get higher numbers of animals, and females tend to give birth where they overwinter, and the babies will stay in that area and they'll overwinter in that same place. And that's kind of one way of ensuring that your offspring have a place. Right. Thought is you have insurance of a place, and female's not going to eat while she's, got, you know, developing an offspring. So why go wandering all over the place? Might as well stay there. You know, it's successful. And you'll see. And then in spring, they'll emerge. In fact, this is the perfect time of year where females will be out and all these babies will be around them. You have three females out on the ledge and you have all these babies around them. So they can, and those are babies that were born in the previous fall. So that way the female can by giving birth at the den site, they can not only take care of them then ensure overwintering, they're not going to freeze, but also on emergence, the female can still protect them until dispersal. So, you know, it's just a lot of these questions are just basically impossible to answer because of
damn it, Eric.
I usually have a lot of questions. And you go, but you know, you can take that way. We approach stuff like that. It's like, we can't do that, but is there an experiment we can do in the lab that's going to tell us whether or not, you know, they return to similar spots or things like that. And it's just good, but that one's really tricky and you'd have to have thousands of baby snakes initially to have dozens at best that make it to sexual maturity and are female. So you cut those dozens in half.
Right.
Half dozens.
I was going to say the other question I had while you were talking is you were talking about there's this misconception that a lot of people think that all pythons go around the eggs and raise the temperature, thermogenesis, all that kind of stuff. But why is it that berms and, say, carpet pythons seem to be the ones that do it? Is there any thought to why? Is it a
Yeah, there is. Is it, there is. Okay. There are thoughts on it. And I mean, they, all pythons that we know that people have had breed female coils around the eggs. That seems to be consistent. I can't, I, it's not that, oh, I had a female that ignored her eggs. It's, but it's by for a species, each species, it's, that is an inherent thing that they do, is they coil on the eggs. But the only ones that are known, you can't say carpet pythons, because we've done jungle carpets. They don't do it. The ones that do it, the species that have done it is the Burmese python, Indian python, which is the same damn thing, basically. It was. Yeah. It's different.
Right.
And then you have the diamond python.
Okay.
And the Southwest carpet python have all been documented to do it.
God, those that makes sense.
Are really good documented to do it. Well, you think about, where do these occur? They are the species that are at the highest latitudes.
Yep.
Northern hemisphere, the Burmese and Indian, Southern hemisphere, Southwestern, and the diamond, which is in the Southeast. They're the ones that are in the extremes. They're the ones that are environments that are the coolest. And so generating heat is a cost to it, right? You're going to burn a lot more calories. And so if you live in an environment where you can find a warm enough place where you don't have to shiver, why would you evolve this? Even if you could do this ability, even if it's in, and we know it's, they could evolve it because these other pythons have, and they tend to be bigger. But, you know, there are a lot of pythons that are the size of Southwest or diamonds that don't do it. They're plenty big. You know, children's python, pygmy python, that is not a chance. There's just not enough energy stores there. But why, if you're in an environment where it never gets that cold, why ever invest in heating? Now, you could keep maybe more precise, but it's not necessary. Why do it? Whereas if you're in these extremes, latitudes, which are cooler, they're not cold by any means, but they are cooler, that maybe there's a greater selection pressure to supplement heat to the offspring to buffer them against potential environmental cooling. Because it's not, to me, it's not just coincidence that the majority haven't been looked at, but it's a handful. But we have data on ball pythons and water pythons and children pythons and womas and
womas don't do anything right. Did you look at brettles by chance?
No, we didn't. We didn't have brettles. I would love to look at all of these, all the different morales, and get an idea. We did Viridis, and they don't produce heat, which isn't surprising. They're in this hot place.
I wonder if Carinata, Morelia Carinata.
That would be a very interesting one, you know. Yeah. But again, it is relatively low latitude.
Right.
So, brettles, you know, if you've been, you know, the Alice Springs area, you know, I don't know, you know, when they're laying eggs, because it's cold in spring. It's very cold at night in the spring. Mm-hmm. Stuff. But when are they laying, or if they're laying their eggs, it's not about, it's about temperature. And plus, they're laying them inside these tree trunks, which may be a really good buffer against environmental temperature. So, you know, if there's the ability to have your eggs incubate without generating any heat for them, there's going to be selection for that. Mm-hmm. You know, and if it involves choosing warm and nest or the timing of when you lay your eggs, it's all going to be better than spending a lot of energy. Sorry about that.
I do have a question on that. So when you're looking at the species that did not produce heat in that study, I feel like a lot of the times you'll get the keeper anecdotally saying, well, I saw it wrapped around the eggs and it was twitching.
Yep.
Is that something that happens without the production of heat?
Again, the way we assessed it is we would basically take the female, put her at an optimal developmental temperature for her eggs, and look and measure her metabolic rate. So she's not generating any heat because they're cut. And then we put them at a lower body temperature. And in lower body temperature, her metabolism, if she doesn't produce heat, will go down because cooler temperature, they're not as warm, they're going to have lower metabolic rate. But if she has the ability or chooses to produce heat, her metabolism is going to go up when she's at a cooler temperature, which is exactly opposite that what you'd predict for any snake that you put at a cooler temperature. And so you don't just measure once, and it's not just you see this occasional twitch. And we have things, we have data like, you know, like ball pythons, they do a little warm. What was the other one we had? can't think of offhand. It was one of those species where there's some heat generated. They're doing a little heat, but it's not significant. They're not contributing. Okay. They're not raising their metabolic rate. It's not dropping as much as you predict for how much cooler it is, but it's also not going up. It's not above where it was there. But it's not as low as it was. So there's some minor type of adjustments to it. So it's not that they don't, but it isn't sufficient enough to actually
do anything.
Thermoregulate the eggs.
So the folks that are at home listening, screaming at the radio that they saw their Woma twitch. Yes, you may have.
You did.
But that doesn't mean that it is a facultative.
Yeah, and they can send all their complaints to Lucas.
Yeah. That's where all the complaints go. Yeah.
But I mean, exactly. That it's not. I mean, that's just you have to see that.
And then nobody's calling them a liar.
When the heat's being generated, you know, because if you watch a snake, it doesn't. It only twitches occasionally. So it's like is it just that occasional twitch that's producing those extra 3, 4, up to 7 degrees that a Burmese python can do, or is it that they actually generate heat by being in tetany, you know, constant contraction, which is muscle use, and the heat and the twitch is just relax and start over again. You know, let's relax and start. So that's the twitch is actually the break. It's not the actual energy the heat producer.
That makes a lot. No,
and we tried to look at that a little bit, but you need some pretty fine thermocouples in the muscle beds to really see and very quick reacting to see when that heat is you know, more heat's being generated. So this odd twitch here, this twitch there is not going to heat the clutch. And it needs to be a regular twitching. And I always trying to stay away from, like, I call it thermogenesis, not shivering thermogenesis, because I'm not sure. We don't know really exactly how they're doing it and how much the shivering and twitching. It's more twitching. But it's just, if you really think of that there's those single twitches, aren't there, especially when people say, I've seen my female twitch a few times. It's like, yeah, it's great, but you know, I twitch a few times too, but I'm not trying to. Right.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I get what you're saying.
We got numbers. I like quantitative evaluation. You know, we see things, which makes us think about what to do and what we can do, but we want to figure out a way how we can take away our bias, or we see something, but is it sufficient enough? And what we're interested in is it enough to make a difference for anything?
Right.
Yeah, the oxygen suppression to the eggs when the female's coiled, is it significant to get a low critical oxygen tension, meaning going to reduce the metabolism of those embryos because the oxygen content's low? And, you know, it's not just, we can find a statistical difference, but is it significant enough to influence the processes, you know, in this case, development, healthy development of the eggs?
Right.
Okay.
Boom.
That's fascinating. Yeah. I love that stuff. Okay. What else do we have on our list? Let's do, I'm curious about, like, we're talking about some myths or things that people in herpetoculture may say, and then.
No, myths in herpetoculture?
No.
We've been on a few.
With our co-dom species, yeah.
What about if an egg rolls?
Yes.
Is that immediate trouble?
For a turtle.
Are you telling me?
You know, I mean,
I don't need to draw X's on X.
If you want to draw an X, yeah, keep them vertical. Why not? It doesn't harm them. They're not birds where they need to roll them. But the difference is turtle embryos attach to the cell wall. Mm-hmm. And so when you roll them, all of a sudden you end up suffocating.
Smothering the baby.
Their yolk, based on it. Whereas when you turn a snake egg, the embryo actually rotates up. And so you can turn it, but they typically always are going to rotate up. Now, initially, you'll see that fertilization spot or egg spot, whatever you want, where you see a little ring and all the embryos kind of, and that's the starting of it. But as that animal grows, it is more movable. So in squamates, rolling them does not seem to be an issue. There's no evidence I know of rolling the egg. Now, I'm not saying put them in a little roller and constantly.
Right. I'm not saying go in there.
Really famous hats doing this. Like one of those bingo.
Yeah, just constantly turning the eggs. It's the best way.
On a little generator with a fan belt. Yeah.
That might be how you get the jag.
But no, I mean, I am not aware of any studies that have shown that rotating a squamate egg has a big effect. And anecdotally, you know, we've got a lot of them just roll over and oops. And even turtle eggs, you can roll them all you want in the first couple few days. They haven't attached yet. And that makes sense because when she lays the eggs, it plops them in. They're rolling all over until, but once it sits and the embryo attaches, then rotating that egg. And why not? I mean, in the wild, they don't get rotated. The only time they get rotated in the wild after, you know, a day would be a predator, you know, and then by then they're being eaten. So what doesn't really matter if you die from, you're not going to die from being rotated because you've been eaten before you do that.
Exactly.
What would be some of the things that hobbyists do consistently wrong or have wrong, or the ideas that they have are wrong when it comes to python eggs or Python egg incubation.
Artificial incubation.
I mean, the one thing, I don't know, it's not wrong, but one thing I don't understand is like people go, oh, I really like to maternally incubate the eggs. And my big thing is, what the heck? Why?
Thank you, God. Because
you're, instead of in an ink, you know, in a some sort of, you know, again, if you put them in crappy little incubator setups, yeah, you might as well leave them.
Yeah,
you know,
but it sucks.
If you put together a nice setup where the eggs, you have it completely controlled. Oxygen delivery to those eggs is much better. We've shown when the female's coiled around it, they get below critical oxygen tension. Those embryos are being compromised. Now they develop and they get through it just fine. But there are non-clinical effects that we can measure on these to doing that. So if you do them away from the female, one is you don't have to worry about the oxygen suppression. Two is you can control the environment very carefully. Three is you can see the eggs. So if one starts rying, you can modify. If you see them starting to cave in, you can do it when the female's on it. You don't see what's going on. You're just trusting her. And, you know, yeah, she knows what to do, but she's evolved to do it in a rainforest, right? Not in your cage. And then the other advantage of doing is if you take the female off, you can start feeding the female again. You know, in the wild, they don't breed every year.
You are making Owen so happy.
This is music to my ears. I've been rallying against this argument for 13 goddamn years. I did send
you the bank account, right? That you need
And we'll talk off air. Like, you know, I don't get it.
I mean, you can have success that way. But again, success hatching versus the hatching quality. You know, we've had eggs that we've split eggs into different things and come out of the same clutch. And you can see, you know, babies come out feeding like crazy if they're really in these optimal environments. If you don't it, they're fine. They'll feed, but they're more finicky. They don't. We look at strike force. We looked at numbers of strikes. You know, to me, a baby snake that strikes is the best baby. Those are the ones that feed well. Those are the ones, and they'll get over it. You know, they're just where the ones that just sit there and go, oh, he's so cute, he's calm. It's like, yeah, it's he might. Yeah. And I'm sitting thinking, but he wants to be striking. Maybe he just doesn't have the strength and stuff to do it. Or so you know, we have different. You know, we do swim speed, and a lot of pythons don't swim, but. Nice thing, put in the water, they do swim and you can control it better. Again, consistently swim. If they're on land, they'll stop every 2 seconds to quit pushing me. So we look at these assessments. Doesn't mean they're not going to survive. It just means chances of survivorship, especially in the wild, is going to be reduced. And so you don't want to just hatch an egg. You want to hatch the highest quality egg you can hatch. Mm-hmm. Some of that's due to mom and dad's genetics. But in my opinion, activity, more of it's due on how you handle that female during that first third of incubation and how you treated those eggs. Because if you don't believe me, take the most valuable clutch you get, divide it up into thirds and put it under different conditions. And I guarantee you'll have different hatching successes and you'll have different offspring quality. If you do that, you know, so, you know, people always blame, oh, it's inbreeding. You know, it's like inbreeding. You know, you bred them one, you know, they're sibling, two wildcat hens have pretty siblings, breeding those siblings, you know, unless there's a really strange gene out there in the wild, which, these common recessive genes are really common in domestic species in humans, but, you know, in the wild, it's not as bad. I mean, yeah, you want to try and have as broad of a gene pool as possible, but, you know, it's amazing how quickly people want to change. Oh, it's inbreeding that did this. And because I got two snakes and, you know, they're not siblings, but their parents are siblings to the parents. You know, it's like, come on. There are really, and especially python eggs. Like I said, colubrid eggs, it's almost like you can do anything to them. Something about python eggs are more sensitive. And again, is that why parental care evolved? Because for some reason they develop sensitive eggs? Or is it because mom's taking care of them? It's like a spoiled brat as a person.
Yeah. Right.
They're incompetent of doing almost anything. I had a student that, you know, he'd never done chores. Like, have you ever washed the dishes? And he said, no. And I said, never. And he goes, Oh, well, yeah. I take my plate to the sink. This is a 21-year-old kid.
And the sink fairy cleans it for you, or right?
I got a mom. You get that.
The dining hall is not helping him learn.
Yeah, no.
No. And I'm not saying you need to make your snakes wash dishes, but
toughen them a little bit. But
you got to pay attention to. You can't control necessarily the genetic side. That's mom and dad. You can control, and also the environment. Control the environment that these adults are, especially males, are developing sperm. If you get a male too hot when their testes are, when they have active sperm, you're going to have either, you're going to kill sperm, or you're going to deplete mobility. And reduced mobility means you get reduced fertility. And again, you blame the snake when usually you got to look in the mirror and figure out what you did. And the thing is, it's not all about, you know, everybody thinks it's like, oh, I got these eggs, and it's everything that's going to succeed or not is based on how I incubate the eggs. Yes, that's important, but it's also the female when she has actual eggs, developing embryos in a female as she's producing her follicles, male as he's producing sperm or maintaining sperm. All those steps are critical. And I think some people just wait too long before they worry about being real careful.
Eggs are like step five.
And then you got to feed the thing, right?
Yeah.
A lot of that is, again, it's not just they hatched or didn't hatch. It's that quality of babies. Because we know we've all had clutches that, you know, they've changed things and you see consistencies and, you know, it's.
Is there something that links incubation or like to yolk absorption? Like if we kind of think maybe it could be temperature, oxygen exchange, something like that. Have you seen anything that might kind of point this in a direction with that?
When you see dehydrate, oftentimes dehydrated snakes, it's real tricky because if you have a female that you restrict water to, because and which I call it really the control group, because they're doing this in the dry season and they're normally not getting water. They don't have a water bowl available. But if you do that, they get dehydrated and they produce eggs that are lighter and also have an increased osmolality. The embryo is even dehydrated as it develops. That's early on, first week. But we also know these parchment-shelled eggs can absorb a lot of water. Mm-hmm. So female laying an egg that's slightly dehydrated, somewhat dehydrated, can fix that by choosing a spot where the egg can take up water. But if the eggs are raised, if they count if females dry, or they're in a desiccated environment, or you have too dry of conditions, eggs gave early, embryo comes out, a lot of times you'll see a lot of residual yolk in the egg that the baby did not absorb that. And when you think about it, what percent of almost any animal, including a snake, is water?
70, 75.
There you go. He is a strong 70, 75. Yeah. Every animal, you know, every terrestrial animal, you get things like jellyfish that are just goo. But
I love jellyfish. And
for yolk is only about 40 to 45% water. Okay. So if you're going to convert yolk to baby, what do you have to add? You got to add water.
Because
as you mobilize some of this yolk, it's only 45% water. To just turn that into tissue, you got to do a lot, turn that into tissue, but it's going to require more water to do that. So if you had limited water availability, you're in a dehydrated environment, you can't utilize all that yolk. Now, one thing they do is you get these, a lot of these, you know, they get these little yolk plugs still inside of them when they're born, right? They're born with a reserve of yolk that they absorb it and they leave it in the body. And one of the ideas behind that is a couple of things. Like some people, it's energy that they can use until they find food. They grow during that time. First 2 weeks, they'll grow if you don't feed them. And that's a result of mobilizing that yolk, high energy yolk, into lower energy tissue in general. Mm-hmm. But also, they can gain weight too. And well, how do they gain weight when they're just taking the yolk in their body and turning the tissue? Well, they're drinking. They have to drink. And one of the things we haven't done, we've tried, is like if you deprive the babies drinking, do they grow less over those first 2 weeks because they can't? And do they leave some of that residual yolk that they can't do it? So I think a lot of residual yolk is more related to water availability to the offspring, unless you really, again, temperature can mess up everything. Temperature is a potent influence. So for most people, you can create an environment, a pretty constant temperature environment for these guys. And, you know, some people want to fluctuate it, but I think for most of these pythons, the nights and the days are not, like I was just in, you know, Cape York, day and night was like 2 degrees difference. Right. You don't have to worry about nighttime cooling, you know.
Right.
So
while we're on the subject of yolk, if I may ask a more niche question, what do you think is going on with the baby black-headed pythons in the hobby that come out with ungodly yolk bellies, like concerningly large yolk bellies? Do you think that that is supposed to be that way, or do you think that there's a connection between maybe feeding a reptile specialist mammals and then the yolk being more rich as a result or something like that?
I mean, blackheads, they're a mess. Yeah, I don't think it's I mean, in terms of keeping them and trying to breed them, you know, it's like every step of the way. I mean, the one thing females do is they yolk up. You know, they always start their follicles and they'll get big follicles, but getting to ovulate, getting to lay good eggs, getting the good eggs to hatch, and get these hatchlings that don't have these. I don't think these large yolk masses are at all normal, because this animal's got to slither around.
Yeah.
For a while. They can't just, you know.
You've seen what I'm talking about, right?
Or, you know,
You've seen what I'm referencing.
Oh, I know exactly. But, you know, in captivity, you can keep them in a little deli cup or big deli cup until they absorb it all. But in the wild, they've got to slither around, or else they're just going to be food for the first bird or mouse or anything that comes by.
Yeah.
So that can't be a normal thing to be that full. And, you know, they want to mobilize it. But in general, we don't know what we're doing with blackheads, in my mind. I mean, walnuts are amazing. They're both aspidites. Walnuts breed so easily. They almost think they're colubrids, you know. They're second to children's pythons in terms of being willing to breed them. They're not, for us, they're not good because they're freak out, you know, they're all the time and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But blackheads just seem, people produce them, you know, but they'll produce them and they'll have these weird babies, or the babies don't do that good, or they, you know, I produce them, but, you know, I have five females, one produced. It's like, is that success? I mean, it's not complete.
You're describing my life.
Yeah. It's like to a T. Yeah.
Which the children's pythons, you'll get 95%. But again, you can screw that up too. I bet you can figure out a way to screw them up too. And I know people that do. Like, I have ways that I overwinter them and all that. And I'm not saying it's the way you have to do, but it's a way that I've used for 20 years and it works every time.
Well, I change it. Yeah.
You know, yeah. And I've shared it and people have, and I know people have applied it to other pythons. People, big python breeders say, now, why? I said, you know, it's only for children's pythons that we've really do this. And it's basically not keeping them continually at a low temperature. It's giving them 6 hours a day of not hot, but increased temperature and the subsurface heating where they can thermoregulate and then cool. And they definitely cycle just fine from that. They get the stimulation, but they just come out more hydrated, more active, more alert, quicker. The starting of reproduction does seems to go well, quicker onset than when you just keep them cool. I mean, cool, like for children's python, 15 degrees Celsius, so 59.
Right. Gotcha.
And then, but then I just bump them up for 6 hours a day up to 20, which is 68. It's still cool, but with subsurface heating for 6 hours, which they, and they will throw, and they sit on that and they love that heat.
Yeah.
We also don't see as many bad sheds. It's just, it really works well. And like I said, I've used it almost exclusively with children's pythons, but like I said, I had a friend who has a lot of different pythons and started implementing it and seeing improvement on some of the Morelia, like diamonds and jungles.
Right. So,
yeah.
You know,
I love that answer.
Ways, but
blackheads a mess. Swiss
blackheads are, that makes them. That's what makes them tempting, right? You fall in that trap.
No, I think you're right on. Yeah,
to me, it's interesting because the fail points are so many places, and none of them are like they're more hurdles. They're not like absolute walls that you stop at. You get past that one or this one, or you get, you know, I got this female through, but. You don't have it really figured out until the majority of, you know, of the snakes are breeding, right? And producing good, high quality offspring. And I don't mean high quality, but you guys mean pretty and all that. I don't care what they look like.
Yeah, viable.
More active, bitey,
might survive.
That's why, you know, I can keep children's pythons and mine aren't the prettiest, but they're great in all those other categories, which I care about. But, you know, it's good to have the pretty thing, but if the, you know, pretty thing is
really messed up.
Not going to feed and you're force feeding. You may be able to get it through things, but you still don't have it right. Because in nature, they're not poor feeders. Now, you do have an animal that's, you know, here, you know, lizard eaters. So getting it to eat pinkies and a lot of these things are tricky. You're trying to feed it something it doesn't normally eat. You know, a lot of times, because you got to look at, do you have babies that just are in a condition where they're just not going to feed because they're not in good health? Or the babies that want to feed and everything, they're just, what you're offering them is not food, according
right.
to that. They're not saying I'm not eating that because I, you know, they're just, I don't recognize that. And you can, like green trees, you can get some that, that's another one. If you incubate them just right, they'll just take mice right away. Baby pinkies, if you don't, you got to get to that lizard or frog, and then they'll eat those. And so, and then you get some that don't want to eat. And so it's, it's not success or fail. There's this whole continuum of where you're at, and the blackheads have all these steps. They're all, you can get past them all, but, and then you think you had it figured out, and, or you get this one female that breeds every year, but the other four females you have in identical cages, you know, one breeds every third year and the other ones don't breed, you know, something like that. It's like, why is she doing this? It's interesting. It's not good for me because I need good for you guys to take on that challenge and be.
He's the only one. I don't want to mess with blackheads. Yeah. I would get too easily frustrated. Yeah. No.
Well, I think that's why, Todd and I get along so well, is we just love the Aspidites. For better or for worse.
You can all share your sob stories. <That's right. laughs> Misery loves company.
Oh yeah, of course.
I am interested. You've referenced a few times perfect incubation, and
yes,
how that leads to better outcomes in the babies. Could you describe for us what perfect incubation looks like to you?
Okay, I'm glad that last point is to me, because to eat, there are many ways to do something right, right? And we figured out for my environment for what is, I don't even know we have two scoops that we use. I don't remember the balance and publish in all our papers, but again, that's why I have papers so I can look it up. But instead of, like, people say, 1-to-1 by weight. It's like, who wants to weigh their vermiculite and weigh it? But if I, tell my students, you get this scoop full of dry perlite in this scoop, and then fill water this high, and I forgot, it's 25 mils of water with 96 grams of thing. Basically, I love perlite. I'm a big believer in it over things like vermiculite. Like, you get eggs that get covered in little dirt and dust, and the more that stuff stick on them, the less oxygen transfer you're going to get, right? And so perlite doesn't stick to the eggs. The water goes inside the perlite, so it's not. If you make it real wet, if you can squeeze it and you get water out, it's way too wet,
Just,
damp. And you do that, the eggs are really touching the dry part of the perlite and the water's kind of trapped inside. And that's what perlite was made for, right? You put it in potting soil to help retain water. It's, it's like a sponge, but it holds that water better. And so, and there are different ways. The best way, I don't necessarily do it, but I think the best way is you do it in a big enough container that you have that moisture that you incubate eggs. You never have to add a drop of water because there's so much moisture. I mean, I've known people that, use trash cans, trash cans with glass on top for one clutch per clutch of eggs. And you got this whole room. If you have the space, great. But you don't have to do anything because there's so much, the proportion of water to your substrate is the same as I use, but you're going to lose every time you open it, you lose water. The egg's going to take up some water. If it's in a small little container, that can be a fair amount of the water and your substrate's going to dry out. If you're in this giant trash can or big, whatever tub. And again, so I do feel that if you have the space and something's really valuable, get in a bigger tub, get that mix and don't, early on I used to just guess it, but now it's like, figure out what works and just, like I said, you don't have to weigh it. Just get scoops and we'll fill that water up, fill this with, mix it, stir it, and you're good. And I usually mix it. We mix it in a lot of times in large volumes. And then, like I said, the volume is important. We've gotten to the point, we used to have a lot of little holes in the sides. I tend to avoid that and just check them check them twice a week by opening the lid, check it up, close it. Tends to, not desiccate. Otherwise you put the holes in but you can do it. I mean, I've done it successfully with holes. It's just, again, when you're dealing with 40 clutches or something, you just don't want to be
everything in autopilot.
And occasionally, you want to catch, if they are sink, I think if they're starting to cave in early, you got to deal with it. You can't just, see if it'll make it through. If it's late in the incubation, that's good news. They're about to hatch. Right. But early on, and a lot, you don't want to go in there and mist them with a spray bottle. You'll kill those eggs, get water on them. So for me, it's dripping, just 1 or 2 cc's down the side of the wall of it. You can do that. And if it's in, you have time, if you catch it early and start acting early, you can actually start doing this. Each day you don't have to say, it's going to need 20 mils. Oh shit. Now I made soup. But this is where I'm getting into more of the hobbyists approach. These are all my anecdotal opinions that we haven't studied. And all the other stuff, I want to point out the difference. That stuff is all facts and organized and, controlled.
Absolutely.
A lot of this is just for this one species and literally hundreds and hundreds of clutches.
Gotcha.
All over 1,000 clutches of these guys.
What, so, what's the temp that you would program your incubator to?
It kind of varies. Usually it's in the 31, 32 C.
Okay.
88 to 90 down there.
Yeah.
See, okay. It's just so much nicer.
It's clean.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, I think people, a lot of people have the temperature side thing pretty good. And I don't, again, I'm not a fan of adjusting it, because I think people go, oh, but a lot of places the air temperature doesn't change much. Like I told you when I was in Cape York, mm-hmm. but even if the air temperature, if this animal's underground in a burrow wrapped around it, air temperature can be changing like crazy. But even down here, we don't, you know, we get 120 by the day and it can get, you know, 85 at night. That's a 35 change. Underground, more than a foot. See, I used our.
Thank you.
I went for metric there. The temperature's constant pretty much all day. And so you don't have to go far to. It's like people when they, you know, especially animals that they go and deep hibernate, or even pythons. Oh, and I just had this with someone with children's pythons. Oh, I took them out of hibernation. I just warmed them up slowly, you know, a couple of degrees a day at a time. And all of a sudden, he had all these respiratory problems. In the wild, the animal's underground. You know, if they're overwintering or whatever, they're underground. And then one day they decide to come up. And when they come up, they're coming up and they're getting themselves to preferred body temperature, at least for a few hours a day, maybe not long, but they're getting a preferred body temperature every day. When you put them at this intermediate temperature, this temperature where their immune system sucks, but now bacteria can replicate much quicker. Mm-hmm. And so you're setting them up for failure. And it's like, and it's not even people, oh, it's natural to, you know, I follow the calendar just, it's like, that's, these animals are going underground and they're coming up to bask. If you see an animal that in spring when it emerges, it goes and basks,
right?
You know, and it's going to heat itself up. And like I said, they're not able to do it all day. They're limiting the duration they can do it. But if you put transmitters in these guys and you measure body temperature, eye button temperature loggers in them, you'll see they go in, they come up, they hit a temp, they stay at the temperature even for a few hours, and then they come down and they go down quickly. There's not a lot of, I'm sitting in this for a week. I'm at this intermediate temperature
in the middle zone.
They don't ramp.
Those intermediate, they don't ramp. And you know, and this is true. We measured this in rattlesnakes. We measured this in Gila monsters and vipers in Europe, and they all do this. They come up, and it's about then. Or as the days get warmer, they increase the duration that they're at that optimal temperature.
Right.
It's still the same pattern, just they can do it longer. And same thing with pregnant females versus non-pregnant. Pregnant females tend to raise their body temperature about a degree and a half over a non-pregnant female. But they also, if you give them a thermal gradient, they'll choose the work to stay at that temperature longer part of the day. So it's not just they're a degree and a half warmer. They're a degree and a half warmer at any one moment, but they're not doing it just for 4 or 5 hours like non-reproductive. They're doing it for 7 or 8 hours. Mm-hmm. So it's additive. It's like they're getting more heat, not only that degree and a half when they're both at peak, but the non-reproductive female will go down or go out, you know, not try and maintain optimal temperature for as long. And again, we've seen this in a lot of times. So you got to look at, and plus pregnant females are much more careful regulators. The variance, the variation that the temperature gets over the day is much less in a female that's reproductive, pregnant female or gravid female, than we see in non-reproductives. So they're doing a lot to regulate temperature.
Okay.
Is that, is that what you were talking about when you were talking about the embryos developing in the female at the beginning? Is that temperature really the thing that you want to pay attention to?
Yeah. Oh, and these females raise their temperature. Like I said, we've published multiple papers about they're raising their body temperature. We've looked at whether they're dehydrated. Do they not raise it? And they still raise the temperature so much, the same amount, because it's critical. If they digestion, they also raise their body. They'll bask more and raise their body temperature. Mm-hmm. But if you make them dehydrated, they reduce the amount they do it. But for reproduction, they're going to go all the way up. And if you look at these children, a lot of pythons, you've seen a lot of pictures and people have published, but they roll over. They're like rotisserie chickens, right? They're like this, and they're getting heated from below or above. They're heating up their belly, but it's like, okay, but what about the other side of the eggs or eggs that are, you know, not all perfectly in line? Mm-hmm. And they'll roll on their belly. And I mean, I get students like, freak out, the snake's dead. and we've even published the frequency at which they're upside down. Now, when they're non-reproductive, occasionally they'll do that. But it's like 10% of the time that they do compared to reproductive. And what they're doing, it's the same reason that you rotisserie chicken, why it's better that way than if you just put it in and let it bake, right? Because you're evenly cooking this thing, and they're doing that. They're adjusting that So they're really careful controlling the temperature and monitoring it. And that's what I said, if you give that female the one thing kind of like, if you get, I do a light, I turn off the heat, supplemental heat at night, because in the wild, they don't get supplemental heat. That's a good way to get bad eggs. Because in the wild, they're not necessarily getting, they're not getting a cold, the air temperature. Now, there are some pythons, berms and diamonds that do, will be on the surface or among the leaf litter. You know, it's like they're on the surface, but they're buried in leaves. Mm-hmm. Or in Florida, it doesn't matter. It's warm day and night. It's humid day, you know. So you got to think about not what's the temperature. You can't look at an atlas or meteorological data and say, oh, what's the high and low of where they come from? Mm-hmm. Right. It's got to be what the snake is doing. And you got to know what they're doing. Are they nesting? Are they brooding underground? Are they brooding on the surface? And then before you go and decide, I'm going to do it more naturally and mimic this thing, you know. And I think a lot of people want to do things naturally, and that's why they eat eggs with the females and all this stuff. But I'm more about
put snow on
knowing what's happening naturally, and then me being able to duplicate it and kind of make sure that I can regulate that and carefully do it instead of assume the female's going to, because you cannot keep your cage at a steady humidity like you can an incubator.
Right.
You can keep that incubator rock solid humidity wise, or you can adjust it if you get a fancy one, whatever. But the cage, it's not going to be as humid, right? And then you're relying on her and her behavior of brooding and all that. When, but
if she's doing the best job that she can do, she might be causing those hypoxic conditions that you.
She's causing those hypoxic conditions. I'm more worried about desiccation in these these cages. No matter how humid, you know, it can be dry, or you get it wet. It gets too wet in there. Whereas again, I can measure out volume of things, mix it together, and that's it. Versus you know, if you're gonna got bedding in a cage, you're not gonna put one barrel of bedding and 1 gallon of water in there and mix it evenly, and then it's gonna desiccate. It's gonna dry out more because it's not sealed very well. Even if it is, you know, pretty like a vision cage, which is mostly closed. But
so it's like water retention in the egg over heat, because there was 1 year where my scrambled brain put a clutch of eggs in my incubator, having forgotten that I had unplugged it because I thought I was done for the year. And this clutch
of
because this clutch of carpet pythons hatched, but it took an extra month than the normal thing. And, you know, obviously everybody's like, well, temperature needs to be this. Well, it was in the 80s, but it wasn't high 80s. I think it was like 82, maybe 80 to 82. And they still hatched all perfectly fine. Babies that maybe were a little reluctant to eat, but still.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. It's success, failure, but also, you know, the quality is a continuum.
Yeah, quality would suck.
Hatch or no hatch. No, I agree. I mean, temperature, they can tolerate pretty considerable temperature changes. Mm-hmm. And we've even shown like gravity fields of different things that it's about getting to that optimal temperature for a certain minimum amount of hours. And then at night, they can, you know, for different things, it just varies depending on where the animals are. That was like with aspic vipers, where they live, it gets cold at night, you know, but that's not what the pythons are doing. So you want to pay attention to the natural environments. But I think water and temperature, I wouldn't say one's more important. I think it's just temperature is so much easier to control. And a darn thermostat, you know, proportional heater, and you're done. Unless you unplug it.
Unless you unplug the thing,
I can't imagine anybody would unplug your incubator when they have snakes in it, but we've all been there. I've been
right. Power outages, if you're in California, it's out of your hands.
But the water is a harder thing to balance, and we do know that these eggs are extremely sensitive to being, they're more sensitive to being wet than they are to desiccate. Well, they're going to die desiccate, but it's just going to take longer. Being wet, it can only take, you know, like, I think, like, I know people, and we do it sometimes, just tilt the cages. So if you do get condensation, or when you start doing that, it sort of rolls goes aside and dribbles, dries on the side, and the eggs are in the middle. So they're not being dripped on, because I swear I've seen where like an egg's dropped and then that it starts rotting right where that drop hit. You know,
Is the mechanism
amazingly
of death
sensitive to water?
Is the mechanism of death in that case suffocation? Does
I don't know. And that's, you know, I don't, it seems like they're prone to fungal infection, because you'll get those and the egg will start rotting. You open it up, the baby's still alive. It won't be for long, but you know, it so I think you're interfering with, you're allowing a fungal or even possibly a bacterial infection on these eggs. But again, why is a python egg more susceptible than a colubrid egg on these things? I don't get it. But again, I haven't down and take eggs, and how much water can I put on a different milk?
how many drops till you die? Yeah.
How many die? It's the quality of the Oscar. All right. it's not the big question, but yeah, I share those same kind of curiosities, and you start thinking, and at that point I kind of become like a hobbyist. I get ideas, and I try, and when I talk to guys like you, I try and make sure you guys understand when it's stuff that we've proven or with data collection and designed experiments versus just, you know, years of experience. And years of experience is important for everybody, and mine's very focused. I mean, like I said, I've done the heat production of a wide variety of pythons, but I haven't had all those species, whereas chilgans I've had for 25 years. And you know, we've done a lot of different things. We've done a lot of things to intentionally not do that. Our goal is not to produce as many babies as possible. So we do things to look at whether it affects quality and things like that. And we see ones that, oh, that didn't affect quality or something that, wow, that did. Or, you know, so it makes helps us become informed without worrying about losing eggs.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, how many baby children's pythons do I need?
I'm curious with, you know, I would assume that this is a temperature thing, but, you know, you'll see ball pythons wrap their water ball at the beginning of like a breeding season. Is that, you think that she's trying to, what, do you have any thoughts on what's going on there? Is it?
I know what you're talking about. Is there a temperature thing? Is it just they're starting to get in this desire to coil? We did publish a paper saying when you get a female children's python, coil around her eggs, you can take her off and you can give her eggs of a different female. Coils on just like they were hers. You can suck the yolk out of all the eggs and then like inject a plaster of Paris, a dilute in there to make them solid. So they look like eggs, but there's no yolk or anything in them anymore, embryos.
Yeah.
And she'll coil on them like they're her own. It's just... the one thing we gave, and exactly the same amount, you know, fully dedicated to it, we've got a bunch of river rocks, similar shape to children's pythons, and epoxied them together and gave her pop. Now, she didn't do it as much, but still 50% of the time that she normally coiled the other one, she was still on these eggs. They're so driven to coil on, you know, what they know they recently laid. They know they're going to coil. So it's, and you think about it, they lay eggs. They're not in a big rookery of all these different eggs. I got to recognize my eggs. I know I laid them in this hole. As soon as I find anything that resembles eggs, I'm going to coil on it because those are my eggs. What else could they be? No one else has epoxied rocks together and pull eggs from a different female and put them in there. Right?
They're really messed up.
Yeah, why?
we think of very evil things to do.
I'm just kidding. I love it.
But you know, but there is this just they're totally driven, and I'm sure it's hormonally driven, probably progesterone or. Could be any of the thyroid hormones that are just driving this innate behavior, which makes sense because, you know, like we think about a lot of bird colonies, whether in trees or on the ground, there's just so many. You got to know your nest. You want to know your offspring versus, and even with birds, they've shown that birds that breed in groups and flocks and rookeries have very good offspring identification or egg identification. Like it, you know, emperor penguin could find its little egg, right?
This is my kid.
But birds that breed solitary don't have those. They don't pick eggs. And that's where cuckoos, you know, cuckoos lay an egg in another bird's nest. The egg could be twice the size of the other eggs, different color. And the female will hatch it. It'll hatch bigger and look weirder than the other ones. And it grows faster and she feeds it. And then it kicks the other babies out. And this other female raises it because she is just not making judgment. Because I know I have my nest in this tree. If I fly back to that tree, any nest is mine. Any egg in my nest is mine.
Right.
Cuckoos evolved the thing of like, well, I don't want to raise eggs. I want one egg. It's a different nest that I find. And so, you know, so we see it. And it's really cool, like within birds, because it's a single group. But if there's a greater risk of misjudging what offspring are yours, then you're going to need the ability to identify your eggs and whether they're good versus these you know, we haven't tried. The one thing they do seem to notice, but we didn't do it in that study. It's not part of the publish, is using rotting eggs. Because a lot of pythons will nose out bad eggs, especially when they first lay them. You see them all around the clutch, and there'll be a couple bad eggs scattered around, either duds or early on they start going bad. If they're not stuck to the clutch, they'll kick them out. So I think they recognize
boob eggs. That.
But that's a different selective pressure. It's not like this is my egg or not my egg. This is bad for my clutch. So I'm kicking it out. So You know, it's interesting, but it makes sense. It's not, oh, they're so stupid, they're coiling on rocks. Right. It's like, no, we're just mean.
Yeah.
I took advantage of their natural history that they lay eggs isolated in a spot that they don't need to. Because, you know, water pythons are known to abandon their eggs, go out and bask, heat up, and then bring heat back. They don't produce, they don't shiver, but they can bring heat to the eggs by basking and going back on the eggs. And so you do need to find your eggs, but I know I laid them down this hole. There's two never laying the same thing. They don't need to distinguish what's theirs. And so you give them something that is at all similar to their eggs. They're going to assume it's their eggs.
So back to the third of the time inside of mom, that period that is very important that most of us hobbyists don't think about because we don't see marshmallow shaped things yet out on the ground.
You need weird like marshmallows.
Fair. It sounds like the water limitation. So that can be one way to screw it up if she can't get water. However, I think you do have some research that they...
We've done a lot of research that, if you limit her water, the eggs come out a little smaller, lighter weight, and a little higher humidity. But overall, the eggs are more protected. She more takes it on, and she'll actually increase. So if you burn your fat, there's very little water in fat.
Right.
So if you burn it, you don't produce a lot of... There's not a lot of water freed from it. If you burn protein, protein's moist. Think about it, beef jerky. Why is it so expensive? Because you're buying a big steak, but you're eating a little strip of meat because you dehydrated. You took away 70% of the weight that they sell per pound, the steak. Now they've got to quadruple the price of the jerky because you're not buying that 70% water anymore. You're buying just the protein. So it's not even just breaking down the proteins and metabolizing proteins producing water, but just the water that's bound in muscle that makes muscle different than just isolated proteins. Mm-hmm. Water part of that. And so when they're dehydrated, mostly they burn mostly fats, but they burn some proteins to produce their eggs, which makes sense. You need eggs have lipoproteins. You got to have some protein to deliver. Mm-hmm. But if they're dehydrated, they'll shift to burn a lot more protein than they do if they're hydrated. And we think that is to generate, to produce that water, to release some water because they don't drink water. They can't, no water to drink. Where can I get water from? Hey, my tissues have water. And we know that that affects their apaxial muscles down their back, right on the side of their spine. They get smaller. They metabolize them more for producing that clutch. Right. And that compromises, we don't do it all the time, but we did initially show them that smaller apaxial muscles mean smaller constriction strength and strike strength. So they're doing it at a cost to them, but they're going, I have a better chance of go feeding and building up my muscle than if I lay a desiccated egg. Right. We'll let the egg be a little dehydrated, but not desiccated, because otherwise I'm going to get nothing. And that, for a female snake, that can be 3 to 4 years of investment, right? In energy. So they can do everything they can to say that. So yeah, they can mobilize water from other sources. There's a limitation, but they do a pretty good job of it. I think in the female, it's more about temperature, because you don't have to worry about the egg desiccating inside the female. You know, you can worry about it being a little high osmolality, but temperature, I think it's a lot of its temperature, not giving that. Yeah, it's an environment where they're cool enough. Or you get them too hot. You know, heat is bad, too. And you get these cages. You want to make a cage with very little circulation to keep it nice and humid. But then...
airflow.
Yeah, I only have the heat on one side. Well, the heat is going to spread, right? Unless you have some airflow in there. And so, you know, you've got to have that ability. These females, they're not always... they sit on the heat most of the time, but they come off of it.
Right.
Move. And, you know, if you have a female and you're... if you have a gravid python... and it's like, oh, she spends all the time on the heat. You're screwing up. She's sitting on the heat because she wants more heat. You're not giving her enough heat. If she's always on the cold end, the pushed against the side, you're screwing up. Like I always tell people, listen to your snakes. And it's like, you know, people go, huh? You know, that doesn't work. But, you know, look at them. If they're always, oh, she loves it. She's always on the heat nonstop. So she's doing a good job. She's grabbing. It's like, she's doing a good job, but you're not. Because she's trying to get as – she's in the hottest place. If she's in the hottest place, that means she's – in need of heat. And so you want that animal that, you know, spends some time in there, but mostly spends about, in my way, I like looking about a third of the way from the heat to the end in there, because if they want to warm up, they can move to the heat. If they want to cool down, they can move away, and they have that choice. Whereas if they're at one end or the other, to me, that suggests they want to go further.
Right.
It could be coincidence that, boy, they're at that perfect temperature at the hottest spot, but you know, I'd rather the hottest spot be hotter and what she wants, and she'll let you know. She'll be just off of it, and you can really look at where they're coiling, and if they're not, you are jeopardizing the quality of that egg that's going to come out.
During that that time as well, could stress, corticosterone levels impact how healthy the embryos and eggs are when they're laid, like when mom has eggs in them? You know, people will be palpating the females, trying to figure out how far along she is, ultrasounding her. Can that be deleterious as well?
There's nothing wrong with ultrasound. We do it all the time. No, but no, we limit it. I can do it every day. It's like, no.
Please don't do that.
It's fine. Once every 2 weeks. I mean, I think there's some, but again, corticosterone is a stress hormone, but it's an energy mobilization hormone. And just before laying eggs or giving birth, if they're pregnant snakes, you'll see a rise in corticosterone to support that process. I mean, it's human babies. So you get an increase in corticosterone prior to birth. So some increase is not harmful. It's an energy mobilizing. Females tend during vitellogenesis tend to have elevated steroids. But yeah, I think if you palpated recently and you palpated a number of eggs, there's no reason to palpate it again. You know, she's cycling of eggs. And that's why I like ultrasound. Ultrasound, you can just pull them, you can put them down, you put the transducer against their side, and you can pick up, you can monitor, because we want to monitor size of eggs, the rate of development, and you know, calculate, but you just grab them and put them down cabinet versus, and I don't like doing it on their belly. I like let them sit flat and then you just do it on their side. It's a lot less, a lot less disturbance. I don't want to say it's stressful now because we don't know how tolerant, because something that's stressful to Lucas may be something that Eric looks at and goes, I don't care.
Probably
you get exposed to it. You know, it's a lot of things. Think about people with snakes. People get really stressed out about snakes. A couple of you guys have cages right next to you, right? You're not stressed out. You get used to it. So, you know, to what extent pythons or any animal, you know, is stressed also depends on how well they're acclimated. If you have snakes that it's really your pet and you're handling it every day and then you breed them, I guess you can handle them almost every day and they're not going to care. Mm-hmm. If you have these snakes like most of us do, when you breed, you don't touch them much. Then all of a sudden you start handling them. Yeah, there's probably some months. It's not good for them, but I wouldn't say never take them out of there. Never, you know, it's bad to ultrasound. Ultrasound's good because, you know, especially when you have a lot of animals, you want to know which ones are going to be more likely to be laying soon or which ones should have laid. Or we look at, you know, ovulation, you know, when they're going to ovulate, because we time our treatments not days, but when follicles get a certain size, then we'll start taking their water away or giving them something or whatever and look at the impacts of that. And then we can also do it during breeding. Once they ovulate, we don't ultrasound them anymore. There's no reason to. The eggs, you know, you can see shell development, all that, but you're going to see it when it comes out. You know, if you're doing it just to solve your curiosity, but if it's actionable, if doing it's going to lead to you needing to do something, because, oh, when they get to the stage, I want to move them, or, you know, for us, we need to treat them, then, you know, there's no issue with it. But never do things that are just for curiosity. Just be patient, you know. But if it's...
And be careful with scissors.
But I want to know because it's going to influence what I'm doing. You know, if I want to, you know. And again, whether the female needs more heat or not or whatever, oh, she's pregnant, I want to give her more heat. It's like, you don't need to pick her. I mean, look at it. Like I said, if she's on the heat all the time, she needs more heat. If she's not, she doesn't.
Right.
Touch the animal to know if you need to give her more heat or not. They will let you know very well because they're going to choose it. So
I did want to talk. I've referenced this paper a couple times, and since you're here, I figured
one of mine.
Yes,
yeah,
it was the one you did with Python Curtis, and it had to do
with my first Python paper.
Yes, with the effects of the male presence in reproductive activity. Like, can you talk to us about a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's kind of fascinating because, you know, there's been a lot of evidence in garter snakes, the Manitoba garter snakes, that the female cycling is heavily influenced by mating by the males. And that mating is what stimulates, sort of like when you think about cats or ferrets, they don't ovulate, they're induced ovulation. I mean, they need a male to stimulate them. And like, if you have a cat that's in lordosis, always screaming, a female cat, I'm sure she's intact, they scream all the time. You know, you can either mate her, or you can just take a glass rod and imitate insemination. And then she'll say, okay, I'll ovulate now. And you get past it. So we see it in a lot of species, but, so these garter snakes, tend to hold off follicle development until they breed, and, you know, they have the short-term sperm storage, which basically all snakes, most snakes are breeding somewhere during early or mid-vitellogenesis. They don't breed after ovulation or right at ovulation. Females have those. If you're breeding them right at ovulation, you're losing out on a lot of opportunity. But what we found with these Python Curtis. I don't even know which one they are now because they blew those up too.
I don't know. Yes, whatever.
If they females that didn't have males would start, all of them would start early follicular growth where the follicle gets grown, but it's mostly water. If you ultrasound, it looks black and you just don't start getting much yolk. And they'll all do that. And they'll start putting a little bit of yolk, start getting a little cloudy. But if there's no male around, they just regress those. If there's the male present with them, they'll go and ovulate, produce. Like, and that doesn't, and it's not absolute, you know, for the study was, but I mean, we live will know that, you know, that I've had a female, I mean, especially some clubs like corn snakes, you know, like chickens, they'll throw eggs if they never see a male, you know, infertile eggs a lot oftentimes, but they'll cycle anyhow. And you'll get in with the pythons, a female that, you know, throws a clutch and she, you know, I didn't want to breed her this year. And I've had it with children's pythons, female that we didn't introduce to a male, because we want non-reproductive group as one of our groups. And all of a sudden they lay a bunch of, you know, bad eggs. So it's not absolute, but it seems to be heavily driven. And you think about the select advantage, why put all this energy into follicles? If a male's not going to find you, you know, and odds are pretty good a male will find you. But if you know that male's there, you want to time it with that presence of the male. And yes, as long as they haven't ovulated, they can reabsorb that yolk in those follicles. But there's energy involved in putting the yolk into the follicle. There's energy involved in taking it out, back out. And so why waste that unless you have this male presence? So, you know, it's an interesting little study that we did on the side. It wasn't part of my dissertation or anything. It's an opportunity we had with these snakes. And it was like pretty exciting because previously, you know, problem with all these Manitoba garter snakes, cool things, they did tons of them because they get thousands of them. They're there, but all of a sudden you're saying snakes do this. And you know, snakes at very high latitude that den, you know, have a den of 1,000, 2,000 snakes do that, but it's not normal for other snakes. So it was interesting to show this, what happens in these Manitoba high altitude or high latitude snakes. We also see in a tropical snake, you know, that, that also we see this thing, and whether it's across the board in snakes and to what, I mean, we also have seen parthenogenesis, right, in snakes. You know, there's no male. Female's never seen a male, produces babies that are just clones of herself. Now, they don't do that often. Most of the time, they're not going to, you know, they don't breed. A lot of females that see males don't breed. But, you know, that we'll never know what drives a female to trigger whether they're going to produce sexually or asexually, because you would need thousands of females taking all your samples constantly in hopes that a handful will actually throw out a clutch, right, and see if they're fertile, and you do the genetics to see the clones. But, you know, this facultative parthenogenesis was thought to be, oh, it doesn't exist. And it was Burmese do this is the big thing. And then and then there's even a paper that shows that with both cottonmouths and copperheads, I think with like 20-something females from the wild, pregnant females that they brought in, each of them had one or two of those clutches ended up being parthenogenic. So it occurs in the wild too. So it's, you don't, and clearly if you're going to produce parthenogenically, you don't have to wait for male stimulation. And we called it male presence because we didn't know for sure whether they copulated or they were just there. I assumed it was copulation, but we didn't know. We didn't have
that.
It just said male presence. So, but I do think it does help to stimulate that process, the onset of the reproductive cycle for the female. And it makes sense. There's that.
Sure.
You know, just to do that. Because you're not like a mammal, like a human, where you're putting out this little tiny ova with a handful of support cells once a month. Who cares? The bigger deal for women is menstrual cycle, right? All that tissue, all that blood that they're losing is enormous. But why did that evolve? Is because it evolved in a situation where females rarely ever ovulated and didn't become pregnant. Because they're in groups and they all got pregnant. They only, if they didn't have enough energy reserves, then they don't ovulate. But if they ovulate, there's going to be male there. But if it doesn't happen, you need a way to recycle things. But yeah, for a mammal, a mouse, whatever, it doesn't have like a menstrual, to throw out this small number of cells, it's not a big deal. But if you're a snake with all that yolk, all the energy that's needed to produce a baby is all there. If you ovulate that and you lose that energy, that's a waste of a lot of energy that took you years to accumulate.
Yeah,
totally.
It's the same reason why females take years to, they're capital breeders, right? They need to collect stores before they decide to reproduce, because they can't assume, oh, I'll find food this week, because snakes may
have
food for months. Whereas if you're a little mouse, as long as there's a lot of grass around and seeds, I know I have plenty of food. I don't need a lot of energy stores to make it through reproduction. But a snake accumulates all the stores, all the energy it needs for that entire reproduction. before it will actually start a cycle, because it doesn't know if it'll get a meal. And oftentimes they're so busy thermoregulating and doing that, that they're not actually foraging. So the odds of seeing the meal isn't likely. Even if you offer a female meal and she'll take it, if in the wild she's not foraging, not finding a rodent trail to you know, ambush, you know, that, you know, she's not, even if she's willing, she's not going to find one when she's just coiled on a warm spot or someplace where she knows it's great for the development, but isn't necessarily feeding.
So do you guys increase the food of your children's pythons coming into the season to kind of get as your buck?
The way we do, again, this is just hobbyists here. Yeah. The way I do it is when they lay, and I can, you know, most of them breed every year.
Right.
As soon as they lay, we just pound them with food. Let's tell you.
Got it.
About just 3 months, we get them to the weight that they were previously. We don't want to get them overly fat. Then we stop and feed them about once a month for the rest of the, until we put them down. And we usually put them down in first week of December, wake up first week of February. So, and by then, so that we get that energy into them early. We don't, we won't want to spread out. And we don't. And then when they, because as soon as they emerge, they start breeding within a couple of weeks. They're not like some pythons that will breed while they're hibernating. And children's pythons can do it sometimes. But again, because we can control it, and I've developed the incubation or an overwintering that avoids females starting a cycle until we pull them out. But it does put them in a good condition, hydration state, that they come out in good shape. They don't have to get, you know,
did the bulk up,
up or anything, food or water. They come out in good shape.
Okay, Eric, do you want to go?
You want me to say it? Okay.
No. Oh no, I can coward. Say it. You coward!
I'll do it. So one of the other common practices in the hobby that I'm sure you are aware of is some people will call it manual pipping. Others will say cutting the eggs, and of course, distinction between the people that are literally sawing the egg in half to see what colors they got and the small slit to allow for exit.
Yeah.
In terms of the physiology of the egg, is there really any reason to do that? Is it harmful every time? Some people say they're worried that the baby won't have an egg tooth and might
drown
the egg.
Yeah.
If the egg tooth breaks off, you know, of course,
because
I know
it
the
bumps
first
into
is,
what's it going to bump into?
Certainly. And perhaps the first thought there is that one wasn't supposed to hatch anyway. What are your thoughts on that?
I mean, I'm not a big, I mean, I know some people are like, oh, it's this day, one slit, I'm going to go slit them all. And, I think snake knows, you know. And again, if they can't, if they're alive and they can't get out, then it's that quality. It's not hatching, not hatching. It's
right.
What quality. And so, you know, if you're real careful and care, you can rescue a lot of these, you know, lesser than optimal quality snakes and produce a good adult snake from it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, so I don't do it. With the children's python, I don't do it at all. Like, I have done it with chondropython because I've always had problems producing really good quality, you know, consistent. So slicing, but then it's only just enough to provide, in theory, provide a little more oxygen delay. I don't know what I'm doing really to do it. Other than, you know, to see the colors, like, what color did I kill? You know, again, it's, you got to be patient and the animal, you know, should slit. And you got to think about if a lot of your snakes are dying full term, hey, you got to look at what are you doing wrong, right? What is different? And I would say you got to look at this metabolism. Do you have enough air circulation in your incubator? Or are they developing to the point where, you know, all of a sudden they're ramping up metabolism? They were fine when metabolism's here, but now it's high that now they're suffocating and they're suffocating the egg. And sometimes you open up an egg that didn't slit and you'll find that it has like, it's folded in half and stuck to, you know, it's odd development. Mm-hmm. Well, you get one that slit, but it sticks its head out, but never comes out all the way. And you'll find that they're
it's all twisted,
twisted up inside and whatnot. Yeah. So, I mean, there's developmental issues that occur, but
during those,
I don't think it's a standard practice. I mean, if you have the last egg or two, you want to, but if you're going to do it, a small slit, because the times that I have slit eggs, most of the time, they just slit it somewhere else and they come out through the other hole.
They've been grown.
That's hurtful. You
know? Yeah. I made you this wonderful path. You went that way. Yeah.
With what you were just saying about dead in term or late term in the egg, with that last 10 days or so when the oxygen requirement is so much higher, is it a matter of simply opening the box once a day to get a sufficient amount of oxygen to those eggs, or what really, how do you meet that requirement?
Well, it depends on how big your box is relative to the, you know, if you have like, again, a big environment, there's plenty of air in there. Right. But we definitely increase the frequency. I'll start looking at them, you know, every day. And, again, because I'm not worried about water loss at that time. They're already evaporating out and condensing everything out in that situation. But again, you know, we're talking just experience type of stuff. But yeah, a lot of it, you know, it's either some fatal mallet development, right, where they're just kinked or their heads, they have no nose, they don't have a face. You know,
top jaw, but, yeah.
You get these perfect good looking things. But yeah, I suspect the majority of them is due to, you got to really think of how did I provide for this late? Because that's really the big difference at the end. If you have this animal, especially if it's all pigmented and everything, you know, it's all done. And, you know, people go, oh, it died because it couldn't slit. Well, right. It got slit because it was oxygen, could not slit for, you know, temperatures, poor developmental temperatures in mom even, but it's now just being, but when it's in mom, it lives while it's in the egg. It doesn't have to do anything, right? You don't have to be really good at anything if you're just sitting in a water world where we were in the amniotic sac. It's pretty easy to survive through that, but then, you know, after slit and survive,
the outside and world.
Make the adjustments to switch from, you know, getting your oxygen from your blood vessels that are on the underside of the shell to converting, constricting those vessels and starting to actually use your lungs. A lot of that is driven by corticosterone, drives a lot of these changes, these late changes to switch over to. I mean, it's a crazy birth. It's kind of a crazy thing. You got to switch real quick to going from, you know, and it's just the lungs aren't inflated, you know, with anything. So that first breath is the hardest breath. You got to fill something that's completely sealed. Think about a balloon that closes all the way. When you got to re-blow it up, it's, you got to blow a lot harder until it stretches. Right. And it's easy to blow, you know, change it. So it is a lot. It's a big demand on them to hatch. And so if you have an animal that's, so that's where, you know, you can say slitting help. A lot of times you slit, still doesn't mean they're going to come out and do well. They're still only dying the egg, even though you slit the egg, right?
Because even yes, if that has happened. My one clutch of blackheads, which I know we've established are all screwed up anyway. So probably not worth talking about, but one of them crawled out and died right in the egg. So right at the end.
And it's, you know, again, it's the whole picture. A lot of times you see the failure at the end, but that may not be the time that you screwed up.
Right.
Because it's easy to survive until you have to do something.
Until you get here.
Well, you have to live.
But yeah, we're still not. And like I said, we all have, and this is what's really cool to sit around and talk to people. It's better if I have a beer in my hand, but I didn't get the delivery. Yeah, I saw that before.
Yeah, well, it's,
I'm sorry, I'm on campus. I can't drink.
Some of us are still in there.
Really? At ASU?
We're number one in innovation, so we decide drinking's not a good thing. But no. Unless you're.
That must be why Santa Cruz is not number one in innovation.
And if the president or vice president have little get together, they can have alcohol there. So it's kind of a biased rules. But
That's messed up.
It's not too far to go to get a beer around here.
Though. Okay.
Well, speaking of ASU, what are some of the current projects that you're working on?
What research you're working on right now, if you can tell us?
Sorry.
This year, the work we're doing with the children's pythons, in fact, a lot of my children's pythons I've moved, sent to another institution that we're collaborating with. I had been, but we didn't have the time. Because a lot of our work is currently looking at using rattlesnakes to look at adaptability to changing environmental conditions. So it has us in the field a lot and stuff like that. But we're looking at immune function and how how reproduction affects immune performance and the response of the embryo to stimuli, immune challenges, like. Instead of challenging them with bacteria and injecting them with bacterial infection and make them sick, you can actually give them lipopolysaccharide, LPS, which is on the walls of all these gram-negative bacteria, these things that get reptiles, and you can just inject them with that. And they're not getting bacteria. It's not harmful, but it's like you're getting poison oak, right? You have this immune response that you're causing the trouble. And so so we look at the effectiveness, the extent of their immune response and how different environmental conditions can influence immune response. So a lot of things we look at is how things like limited water, environment, dehydration affects most commonly digestibility, reproduction, and immune function, because those are three really critical crops that we're doing. And you know, we also, so that's the study being done with the children's pythons. I'm not an immunologist, but my colleagues are. And we also have a big group of Gila monsters. And so we've done some work on looking at how hydration state affects digestion. We've done it in children's pythons, and we're trying to see, I guess some undergrads doing their theses on looking at that effect. We've recently just finished a study looking at how they find water. How do they sense water? So we know they need to drink, but how do you find water? You know, do you honestly aim to find a puddle? Because rain doesn't happen often. When it does, it gets sand and it soaks in the ground. So there aren't that many standing puddles for very long. Right. So, you know, they have to have a way to how they sense it. And amazingly, there's only been a few studies ever that looked at how any animals, a paper in on elephants, a paper on dart frogs that look at how they find water and selected. So we basically made these little tea mazes and have hold on just a sec.
Yeah. No worries.
Hey, I'm in a meeting. I'll call you. I'm sorry. I'll tell you a little bit. All right, bye.
Uh-oh. All right. Did we get you in trouble?
No.
You guys are that guy's yeah. You guys, I can just click and leave.
Yeah.
Wondering where the hell I was. But
sorry.
No worries. What were we even talking about? Now I'm just
water and
I mean, how to find water. You made a tea maze.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Just how Gila monsters find water. And interesting. So we gave them either tried distilled water, which is H2O, and there's no volatile compounds that they give us. So they shouldn't be able to detect it. And they can't. We tried water from, we have a pond with, pupfish in it. So we took water from a pond, which has all sorts of volatile, you know, organic stuff in it. And then we used tap water. It's thinking that, you know, it's the compounds in the pond water that they're going to smell and pick up. And we showed that the only thing that they really smell well in the test was the tap water. And this isn't published. We just finished this. And it's like, what the hell? And then we thought about it. We did this on captive Gila monsters that we've had for years. And what do they get every day? It's tap water. And so
they know the tap water.
We have this great, you know, at some point, like students actually take it and look at, if you give right out of the egg, you give them just pond water and you give them just tap water. And then when you test them, do the pond water ones choose to go for the pond water and the tap water ones look for tap water?
Oh my God.
That's awesome.
And, you know, it's like, it blew us away. It's like, what are you idiots? You're not, you know, this isn't what you're supposed to smell in the bottle of organic compounds.
What do you mean you want the tap water?
No, you got them hooked on chlorine.
Yeah, I was the idiot. They're smelling what they've been drinking for years and they pick up, you know, and you know, and they do. I mean, they have a high preference for going after that. It's interesting. They'll go down the little team is a walk and it's fun. And you know, they lick to the right, lick, and they're actually making a decision. It's not like they run and the first one they go down, they're, you know, they're kind of lumbering lizards, right? So they're lumbering, they're just tongue flicking right at that intersection. And then they choose a direction. And if they're more dehydrated, they're not better at going to the right place versus the wrong place, because it's either an empty bowl or one of the water types, but they get there faster. So they're not more able to distinguish the water, but they're more,
but they hustle
motivated to make the decision and get there quicker. So they get there much quicker, but their percent success rate is the same as the other ones. So they're not jeopardizing it. And these are hydration states that we actually measure in Gila monsters in the wild. We know they get to it. We're not saying, let's see how far they can get. It's like, we know from blood samples that they, during the hot dry season, they get to the, you know, anywhere between what we call moderate and then significantly or considerable dehydrated, which is before any clinical signs. You look at them, you wouldn't notice that they're dehydrated, but we've seen changes in immune function. We see changes in not in any digestive parameter, which is interesting, but except for lowering of their body temperature during digestion. So there are effects. They know their body knows it's dehydrated and they make different adjustments. But in this case, they ACH. And the other thing is the more dehydrated they are, we've also looked at salinity, because if you have a puddle that evaporates and then rains again and puddle evaporates and you're just going to build up salts in there. Mm-hmm. And so you start with highly saline water and you just offer them progressively water bowls of down to tap water. And usually about halfway down our progression is when a moderately dehydrated animal start drinking. The severely dehydrated will start drinking really early. And it's like, are they able to process that highly saline water? Is just, again, making like the water part, making a bad choice.
Yeah.
Ruined it. Right. You know, they did bad choice. Like some people that are on an island, they're desiccating, so they drink the ocean
salt water.
It's not good, but you made a bad choice. And so, but then they, and overall, they drink more water when they're dehydrated. So you know, it's, and these are like curious little questions that either my students come up with, right? And I think has, can I just explain about it? Because we know they have to drink. Eating right. eggs and mammals that we published does not either rouse snakes or heal monsters. They cannot maintain water balance that way. They need freestanding water to drink. And so it gave us the question of how do they find this water? So when it comes available, it's available for a short amount of time. And they can't be just random looking. And you can say part of it's probably memory. They know, you know, they know their home range, they know where the feeding area is. But again, like an elephant uses memory, but they also use the smell of water to know
which
water hole is more likely direction to go in. So, you know, I think these gilas, in no general areas, but to be able to say, okay, I'm in the air, but I can smell the water, just like they're licking to smell eggs or small bunnies or rodents, that they're actually picking up these water scents. But yeah, kind of, it's a weird thing. It's like, well, they smell tap water better than they go to things. But
that's great.
We boiled little bastards. On, you
know, they were smarter than me. They learned that that's what they drink. So they went to what they drink, and we didn't consider it awesome. Afterwards. Like that is, yeah, why
didn't I love experiments like that where you're like, we have everything considered, and then crap, we forgot this. They're like, we didn't think about this. And I love that kind of stuff.
And it's comes so obvious. Like, and other times you get results you don't understand. And you just can't. And you just bash your head, can't figure out what. Why is it different? Like people love. It's always fun when your hypothesis is supported, but it's more fun when it's not. Because when my hypothesis is supported, it's like, good, I know what I'm doing. But when it's not, it's like, wait, I've been doing this 20 years. How come I predicted this wrong? Why? What am I not thinking of? And so it gets you more thinking. It gets you developing new ideas, better than, you know, to how you're going to go at it to really understand what's going on. Because, you know, you get this exposure, like, you know, it's like experience with breeding. You learn things. We're talking about how we do eggs and all that. But my experience with research has also been decades. But sometimes I make the wrong prediction, and so the same thing can happen. So it's good to actually do the work and see what these guys are doing and try and understand how these animals live out there in a place that you'd be dead in, you know, 36 hours.
Right.
They're living, breathing, and perfectly happy there.
Wow. That's awesome.
So those aren't
this Morelia. Conversation.
They're just as cool.
I love your monsters. No, oh, I was been talking about it. For weeks.
Yeah. But yeah, that's just shows that we have a few study species we use a lot. We use rattlesnakes a lot because there are a lot of them out there. I'm not into venom. People, oh, you love venomous stuff. You do gila monsters and rattlesnakes. Like, no. Gila monsters are fascinating because they feed on these nest contests. That's all they eat. They raid nests, and there aren't many nests out there.
Yeah.
And so it's fascinating to me. And then rattlesnakes, because there's a lot of them, and they spend a lot of time on the surface because they're ambush predators. So it's just logistics. And then we do the children's pythons are the three main species that we do most of our work on.
That's cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. This conversation has been awesome.
Amazing. Fantastic. I love it.
Really good stuff.
So where are each of you guys at physically?
Lucas is in California.
Yeah, I know that.
I'm in Oakland.
Yeah.
And we're in Pennsylvania. Eric and I are in Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. We're East Coast kids.
Yeah.
So
I was born in New York City. So
there you go.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, there we go.
Yeah, haven't been back in a long time, but
didn't change that much. So, but we do end up popping around to the West. Like, I think right now one of our friends is on a mission to photograph all the different species of rattlesnake, and we keep tagging along with him to go to different parts and stuff like that to kind of find stuff. And
in Arizona alone, we have 19 if you count subspecies.
We did well in Arizona between you and me, Eric. Yeah.
You guys did do well. I got to edit some of that footage.
I think all total, we're probably up to maybe 20 species so far.
What is it?
KJ, I know Rob is probably like 25.
25, you idiot. Yeah. I mean, I know that KJ sent me a picture today of they found an Eastern Diamondback on the place where we were looking for the one. And it looked 10 times better than the one that we found. And it's just like, well, yeah, a couple months later, and those, they were just emerging. So, of course, mine looked like crap, and yours is beautiful, full body, picturesque. It's like, oh, yeah, okay, fine, whatever. But yeah, they're you're headed out to.
Yeah, 25 is, you're getting close. You're making it hard now.
Oh, yeah, and that's going to get more interesting. Yeah. You got all the easy ones like Timbers out of the way. So, yeah.
Aatrox.
Yeah. And Aatrox.
Aatrox.
The other one. I've seen a lot
of
Aatrox.
It's a fascinating snake. When I had a 1 kilometer by 1/2 kilometer plot, 200 Aatrox on it.
What the hell?
200 snakes. And Aatrox represented probably 95% of the snakes we found there. I mean, they're just so dominant. It's just amazing. And then they can be there all the, and they have a, you know, it's not like a very normal range. You know, they occur all the way from Arkansas to Western California, Eastern California. It's a fascinating species.
That was the one thing that was actually out and about when we were in West Texas. And it was, we went at the worst time. It was freezing cold and rainy. Yeah. And there's an Aatrox. We're like, well, all right, at least they're still here. So we're doing something right. So, yeah, it was.
That's the fun thing of doing research on them. You get to enjoy finding them. Another Aatrox. It's like, yes, an Aatrox. Right.
it's another one added to the pile. Yeah.
Right.
But this has been fantastic. We'll definitely want to try to do something with talking to you about this stuff later on because.
Well, if we wait long enough, we'll forget what we talk. I'll forget.
Exactly. We'll do it. I'm fine with that. We've had 13 years of shows. We can repeat. Yeah. Right. So
but, that's cool, guys. I'm glad. It sounds exciting. It sounds like you have fun doing it too.
Yeah. I mean, if we didn't, we'd have stopped after at least, I think, 3 years. So I think somebody somewhere would have stopped us. But,
yeah. Go ahead, Owen.
I'm saying, like, if there's anything, I don't know if there's stuff you want to throw out there. If there's places where students can contact you, if you don't want to hear from anybody or anything like that, that's fine too.
If you just Google my name, it's there. You'll get my phone, my everything about
everything.
Me.
He'll find you.
Are you looking for grad students or anything like that? Or are you looking for grad students or is it?
Not really at the time because I'm moving toward retirement in a couple few years. And so I'm trying to finish up my PhDs and focus more on masters. I never had many master's students because the hardest year of a grad student is the first year where you got to turn them into something instead of a worthless piece of mass. But for grad student, a master's student, you do that, it takes you a year and then you get a year out of them before they leave. Whereas a PhD, you do it for a year and then you get, you know, four more years out of them and you can get to more exciting questions. You can push them a little harder to get into things that are maybe feasibility is not as obvious. You got to work on it more because you have more time. Mm-hmm. But now I don't want to be, you know, I don't know.
Gotcha.
I'm not going to be 100% retired, but overseeing PhD. I have a lot of my PhD students now are shared. Mm-hmm. I have two that are in my lab, but then.
Well, I had to ask because I found my advisor through a podcast. So if you were, there might be some other little Lucas out there listening.
Trying to get his start somewhere. Yeah,
that's right.
It's always very tricky. Cool. That's the hardest thing you do as a professor out of everything is find grad students and that work, you know, because you're making, you know, you talk to them a few times and then they come out and visit once and then you're making a 5-year commitment to each other. And
you
got to make sure that the person's driven, but also there's a personality match. I mean, I'm very serious about my research and what I do, but you can also see I'm very sarcastic and I like having fun. And you can do both, you know, or you can't be joking about everything though. There's some things that, you know, when it comes to what we do and our experiments, it's all seriousness, but let's have fun. Just like you guys have fun doing these things, right? Yeah. You gotta have fun doing it. Nobody's going to listen if you're bored.
Thank you.
We figured that out early on.
Very quickly. Yeah. Very quick. There's some rough shows in the first couple seasons. But yes. Awesome. Oh, well, this is awesome.
Okay.
I don't know, Eric, do we have any housekeeping or anything else that we need to do?
No.
Oh, cool. No. Freaking fantastic. All right.
No, so, we do not.
Lucas, did you have anything you needed to add before we ended?
No. Thanks for letting me sit in.
Man.
I hope everyone enjoyed. Dale, I could listen to you for years.
Another hour. Yeah.
I can talk for years. Especially if you start talking about, you know, some of the same stories.
It's amazing.
We can do stories. We can have you back and do stories on research and other field herping and stuff, which I think would be a fun thing on that one. So
it's fantastic because you're a wealth of knowledge, but you're also just really fun to listen to. So thank you so much for being here and doing this.
We'll, for several episodes.
I was told by a colleague years ago that it's edutainment that we do.
Of course.
You can't educate without entertaining because if the student's turned off, they're not going to learn anything. You can be very efficient. You can know everything, but you're not going to share it unless you can And a lot of times I'll just have, as you can see, I get sidetracked. I'll start telling a side story. And they're like,
but that's the best.
Where'd you go? You know, it's like, sometimes they have purpose. Other times it's like, I have no idea why I just said all this.
But I don't know how we got here, but show here we are.
Waiting for the story. You know, they get to the whole lecture just looking for a story I'm going to tell about some stupid thing or want to badmouth somebody. You know. Now I have three people I can add to my bad mouthing list.
So. It's fine. It's what we do. Yeah. All right. Well, that's it. Again, Dale, thank you for coming on. We'll definitely have to come back for something. Like I said, we're going to try to get at least three episodes out of you. So, and we'll figure that out later. But anyway, that's it for everybody, for all us here for this week. Check out the Patreon. Check out the Teespring store. Check out all the different discounts we have for rodents, Cold Blooded Cafe, Cold Blooded Caffeine, and that's it. So thanks everyone for listening, and we'll catch everybody back here next week for some more Morelia Python Radio. Good night.